your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday night, October 12, 2025, as we record this show. We've arrived to the Championship League Series after three consecutive nail-biting days, which saw, unfortunately, the Philadelphia Phillies throw a game away to let the Los Angeles Dodgers advance, the Seattle Mariners outlasting the Detroit Tigers for 15 innings, and the Milwaukee Brewers leaning on whatever pitchers they had left to hold off the Chicago Cubs. The stage is set to see who will advance to the World Series. In this episode, we'll preview the League Championship Series as Toronto and Seattle got that party started on Sunday night. Los Angeles and Milwaukee will play on Monday night with tough Game 5s for both Seattle and Milwaukee. Will that be an issue in the Championship Series? Oh, and Andrew Vaughn. Can he continue being Milwaukee's postseason hero? The White Sox are going to have a quiet arbitration period as veterans Mike Tauchman and Steven Wilson and the new guy who joined the team in the final week of the season, Derek Hill, are the only ones eligible. Are they worth tendering a contract? We'll debate that. And the Savannah Bananas released their World Tour schedule for 2026. They'll visit Chicago again, but also playing a game at Neyland Stadium in Knoxville, Tennessee. That stadium seats over 100,000 people. If the Bananas can get 100,000 for one of their games, will Major League Baseball look into matching with a regular season series at a college football stadium? Let's get started. Joining me from Colorado is Sox Machine's managing editor, Jim Margulis. And hello, Jim. We're giving James Fegan the day off because congrats, James. He completed the Chicago Marathon, Jim, and he did it in one piece. I saw it with my own eyes. I know that he at least lasted the 22nd mile, but the app did notify me that James Fegan did complete the Chicago Marathon.
Yes, congratulations. The idea of running a marathon in general, like completing one, running it, I presume most of the way looking at his times looked like it was mostly run. Even walking is a feat, but just hard for me to wrap my head around. I can run about 2 miles and then I get bored. I probably couldn't do much more physically, but even then, like, I just like, okay, I have the idea enough. So to do all of the weeks and months of training and building up to actually do it and then see it through and actually complete it. I have nothing but respect for that. And, you know, everybody else who's out there pounding the pavement. So yeah, congrats, James.
Yes, and also our friend Larry over at Ink and Law. Congrats, Larry. I think he runs it almost every year. So you're crazy, Larry, but congratulations. And also Janice, congrats to her. I saw her at the 23rd mile. And congrats to anyone listening to this. If you guys participated in the Chicago Marathon, it was a great running weather day in the high 60s.
Oh, yeah. My wife asked me, what's the weather like for him? And I looked and like, oh, yeah, because that's... Wasn't it like dangerously hot
yes.
a year ago and to terrible consequences. So yeah, every time, you know, that a race like that happens and you look at like anything above 80, you think like, oh God, it's gonna be hell for him. So to see 67 and sunny, like great.
Yeah.
Everybody can kind of coast, or at least don't have to worry about managing that aspect of it.
Yeah. I think even last week in Chicago, it was high 70s, low 80s. And James was like worried just practicing outside. But no, the weather got cooler. It was good running weather. Again, for all of our listeners and all our friends that participated in the Chicago Marathon, congratulations, but especially to you, James, and he's rewarded. He's going out on vacation for a week, so we gave him some extra time off as we're placing him on the 7-day injured list. Moving over to baseball, and it's all about the championship series in Major League Baseball. As we are recording this, Game 1 of the American League Championship Series has started between Toronto and Seattle. George Springer really started that game with a bang, hitting a solo home run off the first pitch he saw from Mariners starting pitcher Bryce Miller. And the Mariners were challenging at least in the first inning, there was a contact play that Cal Raleigh got thrown out at home plate. A bit surprised Seattle didn't challenge it, because it looked at it during replays of that play at the plate that maybe there could have been an argument that Raleigh did slide underneath the tag safely at home plate. But with the championship series now starting, Jim, from a White Sox perspective, I find that the camera lens and the spotlight continues to find Andrew Vaughn. And if you're a Milwaukee Brewers fan, it's for all the right reasons. Tied 1-1, Andrew Vaughn in Game 5 hit the go-ahead home run for the Milwaukee Brewers, a solo shot to give him a 2-1 lead. They ended up winning that game 3-1. Andrew Vaughn, who went from the worst position player in Major League Baseball when the White Sox demoted him and optioned him down to Charlotte, got traded for Aaron Civale, is now 4 wins away, Jim, from playing in the World Series. Can Andrew Vaughn continue being Milwaukee's postseason hero?
Possibly. Like, the way he's been deployed by Pat Murphy, you know, somebody who, you know, if the matchup's right, like at least how it started out with Milwaukee, like he stepped in for Reese Hoskins. They weren't expecting a lot. So they put him in when the matchups favored him or when they could put him towards the bottom of the order, and he produced. And then like he kind of went through a lull in August where he looked like more or less the White Sox Andrew Vaughn, not like this year's White Sox Andrew Vaughn, but more the Andrew Vaughn of previous years where he gets hot and then he gets cold. He, you know, hits into, you know, some double plays and it just kind of washes out to a league average hitter with not much else going for him. So then he introduces Jake Bowers to line up more, and Jake Bowers takes more of the plate appearances against tough righties, and Vaughn faces lefties and maybe righties that don't have the kind of sliders he might struggle against. And then he bounces back for September, looks great again. And so I think the way they've been able to manage him as a complementary player or a, you know, supplemental piece, somebody they're not counting on, somebody who's not a bedrock of the lineup, you know, he doesn't have that first round pick, third overall pick expectations that he had with the White Sox, that you're carrying the torch, you're taking the torch from Jose Abreu, you're going to be the centerpiece of the next rebuild, hell or high water, and then the high water kind of, you know, overtakes him. In this case, just you're found money, and we're going to, you know, use you wisely and see how far you can take us. And then, you know, if you can't quite get it done, you're not a great bet to get it done, we will shift it to, you know, our Yelichs and our Churios and our William Contreras's and so forth to, you know, carry more of that weight. But, you know, I saw on our discussion page in the comments in the sites, Phil talking about Connor Gillespie when he hit that huge three-run homer against Familia in the Mets series, the Giants Mets series. And, you know, he was going nuts and he got this kind of a hero's welcome in the clubhouse where everybody's chanting his name. And he was so, he was so reticent with the White Sox and so, you know, hard to excite, comically so. And to see him fired up in that context was just, just so enjoyable. And with Vaughn, it's kind of similar, except that he's still not a good quote. Like, he still can't give anybody, any reporters, anything to sink their teeth into in terms of, like, how did this turn around for you? It's all just kind of platitudes or one day at a time or just, you know, which, you know, he does have to take it one day at a time given just how he scraped bottom this year. But still, like, you know, if you're looking for him to be like the great story, at least not yet. Maybe, you know, if they somehow see it all the way through and he wins an MVP either in the League Series or the World Series, you know, maybe then he'll lighten up a little bit and you know, maybe his agent will say, like, you gotta share something about yourself. But until then, you know, just it's good for him, and then he's still just, you know, keeping his eyes on the road.
Yeah, Vaughn hit 2 home runs in the series against the Chicago Cubs. Film critic, very famous, Richard Roper, big White Sox fan, tweeted out that Andrew Vaughn has done the improbable. He has pissed off both sides of town, White Sox fans and Cubs fans this season. It's surreal. It's like not even the same hitter, honestly. That was with the White Sox, and maybe that does happen. And I know that a lot of people chime in that that's a natural thing that happens. Somebody leaves the White Sox and they instantly get better. but I was listening to From the 108 podcast, and Beef Loaf was talking to Ozzie Guillen Jr., and I thought Ozzie Jr. made a good point, is that sometimes as a major leaguer, when you get demoted or you get non-tendered or you get cut, that's the type of kick in the butt that you need to find focus, be more open to coaching, to make the improvements, to get yourself back on track.
Carlos Rodon.
We saw that with Carlos Rodon.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I beat you to it.
Yeah. Not getting anyone out in the 2020 postseason, possibly getting Rick Renteria fired because of that outing against Oakland, getting cut, nobody wanted him, having to settle for a low deal to come back and battle for a spot in the starting rotation and put together the season that he did, and he used that as like a launching pad to be the Carlos Rodon that he is now, and he's made a ton of money. But that's what it required for Carlos Rodon, and maybe this is what Andrew Vaughn needs as well. Because, Jim, he's still, like, year to year. Like, Milwaukee has to decide, do we tender Andrew Vaughn a contract or arbitration? Based on what they have seen this year, when they have had him, that's probably an easy decision. Sure, we'll let Rhys Hoskins walk. We're going to get him. We were supposed to pay him, like, $14, $15 million. And for half the price, we could have Andrew Vaughn. So I'm curious to see on how this is going to play out for Andrew Vaughn for the rest of his career. But I do buy into that type of idea and theory that sometimes for some major leaguers, especially high draft picks, when it doesn't work out, the change of scenery sometimes is forced upon them and they have to force to make the adjustments necessary to get back on track. And that's what Vaughn has done.
Yeah, even like it's not so much a case of, you know, it could be a case where somebody's stubborn and just doesn't want to. It could also be a case where a player is considering something or, you know, has been suggested something, but doesn't feel right. And it's a case where, you know, maybe Vaughn's like, I don't want to strike out seven times in eight plate appearances in a major league game, in a major league series with games that count. Like it feels too off. I can't do it. And so just going to the minors just provides that low pressure environment to try something, to experiment, and ultimately decide whether it works. Kind of like Colson Montgomery. Colson Montgomery had it one level down, but going from Charlotte to Arizona, where, you know, first of all, he wasn't playing in games. Then when he did play in games, games didn't really count, or, you know, they didn't matter as much as AAA stats, the AAA context, with the kind of performance and stats you're used to seeing from yourself and others. So, you know, it worked for him, even though it didn't turn out that he made like significant changes. He just found out what, you know, he needed to do better. Could be the same case for Vaughn. And you know, I tried talking to him about Nashville, and he just, you know, mostly spoke about, you know, trying to get it right. He's not going to be forthcoming about analytics. James has talked about like how you have to present something to him. Like you have to present found evidence for him to confirm or deny, and he'll say it, but he won't bring it to you himself. And even when I saw him in Nashville, though, he hadn't done anything. You know, he hadn't been producing at this level in AAA. It was okay. It was better than he had been in Chicago, and kind of the standards of a decent AAA hitter, somebody, you know, somebody like a Zach Deloach or something like that. Like, you know, he's worth plate appearances in AAA, maybe a bit of a tweener, you know, from the performance he was showing. So he wasn't Andrew Vaughn, you know, capital, you know, all capital letters, until he arrived in the majors and just either, you know, he was playing less pressure because he didn't have the expectations of Chicago on him and didn't have to be that everyday guy. Or maybe it's a case where it was a matter of him making some tweaks and then having games that counted to kind of fire him up even more. Like I said, hopefully he'll have a storybook ending to this postseason where he, you know, he gets a ring and maybe an honor, and then the Brewers give him a contract. And so he can feel like, okay, I've done what I can with this year, and I can talk about it a little bit more. And I'm not going to be jinxing myself by declaring victory or saying something has been fixed too soon. Because if you win a World Series, you win any kind of MVP honor, or you have these kind of huge moments, even if it doesn't result in MVP, it's in the past. It's locked in. It's on his record. Can't be changed. You can talk about that at least a little bit.
Well, if the Brewers beat the Dodgers and go to the World Series and win the World Series, there's going to be books written about the Milwaukee Brewers in 2025, winning their first world championship. Andrew Vaughn would be a chapter. Mm-hmm. He would be a significant chapter for the Milwaukee Brewers. So whichever beat reporter, whatever writer in Wisconsin decides to write the book of the 2025 Milwaukee Brewers, you have a challenge to get Andrew Vaughn to talk about what happened with the White Sox and why it didn't work with the White Sox and why did suddenly everything click in Milwaukee. Because you have tried, James has tried, everyone has tried.
And yeah, no, Kyle Williams just took Vaughn a shot to covering it for the Sun-Times. He took a shot at it, and Milwaukee's local reporters have taken shots at it. You know, nothing captivating, but it sounds like, you know, reading, even like there was a foul territory appearance that he made. And he had ex-players, you know, peers talking to him and still, you know, had to try to do multiple follow-ups to try to get him to say more. And it almost sounds like, you know, he talked about how when he got to Milwaukee, found some teams to go fishing with. And that was something that was a bonding experience. So it seems like a reporter has to say, like, let me take you fishing. Let me take you to a great spot on a boat for 8 hours. You have to talk at some point, don't you? And if he doesn't, then you can kind of know that it's not going to happen.
Great fishing spots in Wisconsin, so I'm sure somebody can unlock that. But I'm still curious. We still it feels weird, Jim. It's like an ex relationship where you never got closure. You never know. You don't know why it didn't work out, and you're still curious and why it didn't work out, even though everyone has moved on. But yeah, that's kind of where I'm at right now with Andrew Vaughn. Again, Vaughn just 4 games away from playing the World Series after being demoted by the White Sox.
Yeah, I guess I don't hold that against them just because the White Sox, you know, the late-stage White Sox under Kenny Williams or Rick Hahn just managed it so poorly. They probably, you know, overall, they probably just didn't give him a chance.
Well, for the first game of the American League Championship Series, again, it's still ongoing as we record this. So we're going to speak just in general. As we're recording this, Toronto's still leading Seattle. But something that caught my attention, and this is a continuation of the conversation I had in our previous podcast episode, and how power ages. And it shows that there's a decline like almost immediately when it comes to bat speed and max exit velocity as players get older. When they get older, they got to find a way to pull the ball more in the air. That helps out with power numbers later on, but this is something that's a concentrated effort for even some of the best hitters in Major League Baseball, especially going into this offseason, is bat speed training. Well, what Mike Petriello found was that Toronto has been the last 2 years one of the best contact teams in Major League Baseball. They have been a tough strikeout. They were that way last year, not as successful this year. So what's been the difference? Well, he found that, and there's more nuggets of information that I'll share about the postseason and winning percentages in the last 10 years. But with each passing month for the Toronto Blue Jays since the month of July, they have increased their team bat speed. And right now in the postseason, they are averaging, as a team, a bat speed of 72.6 miles per hour. That's more than a mile per hour than they were at the end of the regular season. And it sounds like from this reporting that Blue Jays hitting coach David Popkins, who came over from the Minnesota Twins, he told Sportsnet up in Canada that that's been the team's focus, especially after April, that the team had to swing with more intent and have a concentrated effort that on that first pitch, even if it's in your wheelhouse, as long as you swing hard and you got a bat speed greater than 75 miles per hour, we know that you put all the effort into it. And if it's bad luck, it's bad luck if you pop it up or you ground it out. It's more about a concentrated effort to swing with more intent, especially earlier in the count. Well, game one of the American League Championship Series, the first pitch that George Springer hits, he hits a home run. The bat speed, 77.4 miles per hour. I looked it up for the White Sox. The Chicago White Sox as a team ranked dead last in Major League Baseball in team bat speed. They're the only team to average below 71 miles per hour with the bat speed. So, Jim, ever since that conversation with Travis, and again, with Toronto, it's not just about they put the ball in play and they're a tough strikeout. It's the quality of contact. As we're recording this, they've already hit 10 home runs this postseason in 5 games, and they decimated the New York Yankees pitching staff. I wonder if this is going to be the thing heading to the off season. And you, if you get a chance to tag along with the White Sox director of hitting Ryan Fuller down in Nashville, if every team and even some of the best players are going to be focusing on how can I improve my bat speed, because that might be the countermeasure against all this velocity and all this spin that we're seeing from pitchers.
Oh, it certainly seems like it. It seems like there's no argument to like swing a bat slower. Like, you know, you hear about like a...
Well, the idea was if you swing it slower...
More barrel control.
Barrel control, yeah. Right.
So I could see like... I think it's a tool to have in your arsenal. I imagine like somebody like, you know, to think about prospects, Sam Antonacci is somebody who, you know, has really kind of a flat bat path, not a whole lot of load, you know, or separation between like his hands and his legs in terms of like really loading up for power. You know, he tends to take like a path from like hands back, hands through the zone, and he prefers to be able to shape the barrel a little bit, high, low, inside a pull swing, inside outing swing, to, you know, get singles here and there. But I'm sure that even he would like to have like a better A swing in his arsenal to be able to capitalize a mistake, because, you know, he's going to have to earn every homer he gets with the current swing he has, like unless he, you know, overhauls an entire swing. So even to gain like a mile per hour velocity, just to go from, you know, you get five homers this year to like 9 or 10 with the kind of plate discipline he has, that would make him a lot more valuable. So I think every hitter would like to have that. Whether or not it changes like his plate appearance, you know, going from game to game, plate appearance, you know, you might not see the A swing every time, but I think every, you know, just like every pitcher would like to have more velocity. You know, they don't want to have it at the expense of command or control. You know, it does no good to, you know, go from 96, 97 if you're, you know, missing the strike zone, you know, 2/3 of the time. So, you know, we don't hear about any pitchers saying like, I need to throw slower, I really need to improve my command. It's all velocity gets me there. So that's, you know, that seems like it's going to be the focus. It is cool though that we can track this. And I think it's similar to, it reminds me a lot about, reminds me a lot of pitch framing, when that started to get tracked and runs started to be assigned to it. And you had catchers who were great at it and were always praised for it, by like Jose Molina, you know, not much of a hitter, very, very, very Molina slow, but because he could receive so well, pitchers love throwing to him. And you wonder like, why does he get so much playing time, for a team like the Rays or something like that? And it's because either they were tracking it or they knew that that means something to have more strikes or to have, you know, more pitches go your way. And then once you started tracking it, once you started having pitch FX, understand which balls should have been strikes and vice versa. And you see like, you know, the Molinas versus the Ryan Domits of the world. And you just see this huge, I forget how many runs it was at its peak, like something like a 50, 60 run disparity between the best catchers and the worst catchers. It really opened your eyes to what people were saying all along, what scouts were saying all along. And once you could start tracking it, then teams got better at either developing it or finding catchers who were better at it. And then this, even though you have very, very good framers, the they're not as valuable just because the floor has been raised so much for playable catchers to where every team is some level of competent at it, by and large, unless you just have an extreme situation. So to see this now, you know, for, you know, at the major league level of StatCast, and then applying that to watching minor league games and, you know, watching the Birmingham Barons who get by on hit by pitches and walks and stolen bases. And then you see like somebody like Braden Montgomery join the team and you see the way his bat goes to the zone. You say, oh, that's bat speed. You can get lulled into just swings that are adequate for the level and, you know, kind of treating homers versus doubles versus deep flyouts as luck or wind or what have you, and say like, oh, you know, too bad, go get it next time, versus like, oh, even like Jackson Chourio, seeing him in Nashville up close. And though he's not impressive, you know, his wrists and, you know, forearms and such, you know, the you know, those muscles are impressive. But in terms of build, he's on the shorter side. You know, I'm taller than him. You know, he's not somebody who stands out if you see him walking with other players. But then you see him in the batter's box. You just see like the whoosh of the bat going through the zone. You're like, oh, I get it. I get why the sound is different. I get why the ball travels more. I get why ball shoot through the infield, or they make outfielders turn around, or they go over the fence. So it is very cool to see the to see the information and then see people who have either been working on it with proprietary information that hasn't been shared, telling you more about it because it's publicly available. And he is like, you may as well, if everybody can understand this information, they may as well be, or if everybody can access this information, I should say, I may as well help everybody understand it. That's the cool thing about this being publicly available.
Yeah, two hitters in particular, and this might be better off as a blog post during the off season, but like Chase Mydroth and Edgar Caro, they need to do some bat speed training this off season, or just when they start doing their off season programs, they have to have a better understanding of what pitches that they can swing with more intent than they did this year. Kyle Teal's got room for improvement. Teal only averaged 69.5 miles per hour with his bat speed. Obviously, you don't want to compare everyone to Colson Montgomery, but Colson Montgomery has elite bat speed that everyone is going to be coveting. And it seems like that target right now is 72 miles per hour when it comes to bat speed, and there's still a lot of teams as a team below that total. But the Toronto Blue Jays have increased their bat speed, and as we're recording this, Cal Raleigh absolutely just destroyed a baseball to tie the game 1-1, and Cal Raleigh's bat speed has been ridiculous this season, and Ohtani and Judge and Schwarber, you want to be a power hitter, you got to swing fast, and that might be one of the reasons why the White Sox can't quit Luis Robert Jr. In this same piece from Mike Petriello on MLB.com, and for podcast listeners, I've linked the page on the podcast page on SoxMachine.com if you haven't gotten a chance to read it. Against the Yankees, Blue Jays hitters only struck out 15% of the time. So yes, that is key, not striking out all that often. In the postseason, in the last 10 years, teams that have hit more home runs than their opponents have an .823 winning percentage. Okay, ball go far, team go far. Teams that strike out fewer than their opponents have a .640 winning percentage. The teams that do both, out-homer their opponent and strike out fewer times, have a .900 winning percentage. That's your secret sauce. Yes, put the ball in more in play, but quality contact matters a great deal as well, because Petriello also wrote, Jim, the average fastball velocity from right-handers this postseason, 95.7 miles per hour. We are getting close to where, when I'm watching college pitchers and high school pitchers, that 50 grade velocity fastballs for righties is going to be 95, 96 soon. And that is crazy. That used to be closer speed when you and I started watching baseball.
Oh yeah. Like Matt Thornton from the left side, like, oh, he's hitting 96. Wow. What an arm. Looks so easy coming on the left side. And you get up to 98 sometimes, but yeah, it was just, standards are different. Going back to the bat speed conversation real quick, because I was looking it up with the White Sox. So Colson Montgomery first, 77.2 miles per hour. Luis Robert second, 75 miles per hour. Those make sense. Do you know who's third?
I think is it Will Robertson?
It is.
Yeah.
So that's a good example of the White Sox seeking it out. When he was on the outside looking in with the Blue Jays, because they had too crowded of an outfield, the White Sox saw an opportunity to get bat speed. Obviously, it hasn't worked out yet, but that's a case where it shows that they're looking at it. If you're wondering why he got so many plate appearances with the White Sox over the last 3 months up and down, that's why. Because he produced a lot at AAA, and there's a reason for it besides just feasting on bad pitching. There's actual bat speed and exit velocity to matter with it. And like his intense swing, like his fast swing rate, that's also third. Nearly half the time he's getting like an ace swing off. So that's why they got him. That's why he might be getting more chances than you think, even going into next year, because they see something and they don't have much of it. So they may as well try to get it from elsewhere.
No, that's a good point, Jim. That's a good point. I didn't even think about that, but yeah, that's a good example of seeking it out. Over in the National League, Dodgers and Brewers, the Dodgers are doing it again. When you think that they're not that strong, you think that, oh, their bullpen's going to melt down, they keep winning. It might be in weird ways, but they do find a way to win. But they're going up against a Milwaukee Brewers team in which the Dodgers this season 0-6 against the Milwaukee Brewers in 2025 during the regular season. So, Jim, do you think that carries over into the postseason, or is this like a fresh slate? Like, you don't care as a fan what the regular season records were if they were that one-sided, that once it's in the postseason, everything goes out the window?
I think from the Detroit-Cleveland series, and given the way Cleveland should have demoralized them over the regular season, then Detroit wins and advances and almost advances again. I think that shows the limitations of momentum, or at least the idea that a team can be another team's head, especially one as good as the Dodgers. Yeah, I looked it up just out of curiosity. The Brewers did play the Dodgers twice, basically around the All-Star break on both sides in mid-July. So you catch a team at the wrong time or the right time, depending on which side you're on, when they may not, you know, be at full power or just might be in a funk or, you know, working through some things in terms of roles, to where, you know, the Brewers were happy to play them then, but you know, given that the Dodgers finished the season pretty strong, Brewers did as well, but I imagine both teams have to be confident about it.
Yeah. Do you think that the tough game fives, and again, we're recording this as it's 1-1 of the sixth inning between Seattle and Toronto, if you want to track along with us podcast listeners in case that you're listening to this on Monday, do you think those tough game fives for Seattle and Milwaukee are going to play a factor in their respective championship series, Jim?
I think it could if there is a string of one-run games, close games, because you see a pattern of relievers getting worn down by the end of series or by the end of October, just the amount of appearances they're expected to make with the high-leverage relievers, the amount of times they're expected to go four or more outs when they rarely did that in a regular season. Makes all the sense in the world in terms of wanting your best guys out there, but there is a toll that seems to that teams seem to have to pay in order to put that much pressure and work on somebody. So I can imagine, you know, maybe not in the game, you know, games won for each teams, but you know, as the series goes along, if they're playing 4-3, 3-2, or games that are, you know, winnable in the eighth inning, on and on, I could see it being a case where a manager just runs out of options to where like they feel like they have to keep going back to the best guy, and their best guy just either because of overexposure or because of just wearing down, that it becomes a less useful answer. So I wonder, you know, right now the Mariners and Blue Jays are tied, playing another close one, but probably not the worst thing in the world in a seven-game series. If there's a blowout somewhere, like ideally the Mariners or the Brewers would win like 8-1 and be able to use some low leverage guys and be able to reset the usage clock on some pitchers that way. But, you know, if it's early in the series and they lose big early on and they can use like their long arm for three or four innings just to get through a game and save everybody who they trust for a different game, in a seven-game series, that's fine. You know, that helps. I think in the five-game series, you have to try to win every game that's possible. And actually, the Mariners just took a 2-1 lead as I'm watching this. So a little peek behind the curtain here. But yeah, that's, I think, watching the usage patterns, seeing, yeah, I think the Brewers, I think, are in a pretty good spot because they have some ways to mix and match through the middle innings to where it's not all the same formula, 6, 7, 8, 9. The way they're using Mizorowski right now, I think, is pretty cool to buy some innings and just see how long he can go and keep using them. So that's, I think, a weapon that, you know, as long as they're able to recharge him in a timely fashion, like if he can be deployed in a way that saves a game or two for other high leverage relievers, that could be pretty valuable against a Dodgers team that, you know, even though they've been, you know, they've gotten to the NLCS, there have been a lot of scary moments and a lot of moments where they wobble and say, here's the Dodgers bullpen again. So if that ever happens in a game where it's a one-run game rather than a five-run lead or something like that, you could see a serious turn on that. So I think if the Brewers can get there, and not the easiest thing in the world when the Dodgers are pitching the way they are, that's one way I think the series can kind of turn.
Yeah, Ashby for the Brewers can be quite lethal against left-handed hitters, and the Brewers are going to need him. Otani and Freeman, Muncy in key situations. I'm wondering if he's one of those that gets overworked in the series.
Yeah, could.
Like, all right, here we go. You got a one-run lead. Runners in scoring position. Here comes Ohtani. Well, you got to go to Ashby. Now this is like the second or third time Ashby has faced Ohtani. Is Ohtani picking him up now? Yeah, I could definitely see as this series gets deeper. So maybe not early in the series, but games 3, 4, and 5, it could be pretty critical with just how tough a series both Seattle and Milwaukee are coming off on. But I'm excited for the championship series. We'll keep talking about it and keep covering it on SoxMachine.com. It'd be great if it is Seattle and Milwaukee. We talked about that in our postseason predictions segment a few podcasts ago. I'm kind of expecting Blue Jays and Dodgers because I never get what I want when it comes to Major League Baseball. But fingers crossed. No matter what combination, it should be a pretty exciting World Series this season. Now for the Chicago White Sox, not much on the news front quite yet. We haven't heard any gossip as far as any potential hiring targets for the White Sox coaching staff. We may not for a while. The White Sox may want to interview coaches that are currently on postseason staffs. But the White Sox and the arbitration front and these numbers...
The Brewers are still playing.
The Brewers are still playing, yes. These numbers come from MLB Trade Rumors, which always a cap tip to those guys, figuring out arbitration values. They are pretty accurate. If they're not exact, they're within striking distance of the target. So they always do a really good job with this. When you have your offseason plan project, you're only going to have three players to decide if you're going to tender a contract to or not. Mike Tauchman, which his arbitration value according to MLB Trade Rumors is $3.4 million. Reliever Steven Wilson at $1.5 million. And new guy, outfielder Derek Hill at $1 million. Now, I don't want to influence too many people's offseason plan projects, Jim, because I want them to make the case if they do think it's worthwhile to bring these three guys back. Spoiler alert, I'm probably not tendering a contract in my offseason plan for those three, and that might even surprise some when it comes to Mike Tauchman. But Jim, what's your gut feeling now when you see these numbers and you see the players attached to them? Are the White Sox going to tender a contract to any of these guys? Or do you think that thank you for your contributions in 2025, but we're going to try to find new faces?
I think Tauchman's a no. It doesn't mean that I can't bring him back, but just we saw last year with the Cubs that he was healthier. He had he was better in terms of rate stats this year, but not worlds better than he was with the Cubs. And his tender number or his projection for the Cubs was $2.9 million, and the Cubs non-tendered him. And then the White Sox brought him in at $1.9 million. So the fact that he's a year older, he played really banged up last year, had knee surgery, and now the figure is $3.4 million, seems kind of similar to where they might bring him back, try like $2.5 or $2 million or something like that.
Okay.
That's kind of my gut instinct, the way that Chris Getz has not talked about him as somebody they're bringing back or somebody they're tendering. He's been very open-ended about it, very elusive when trying to pin him down. Talking about Tauchman's influence, it's always in the present or past tense versus this is going to be a thing that keeps going. So I would expect him to be a no. I think with Steven Wilson, his figure, $1.5 million, the fact that MLB Trade Rumors can be off by a few hundred thousand here or there, there are frequently in this exercise in the past, some relievers where I'd say non-tender, like a Matt Foster, at seven figures because he's kind of interchangeable. And then he ends up signing for like 900,000. You think, oh, that's fine. So I think with Wilson, 1.5 million is in that, I think the middle of the debate zone to where, if he ends up signing for 1.2, sure. That's like less than a half million over the league minimum. He shows the ability to get hitters out sometimes in important situations. The White Sox bullpen is so open that can't hurt. But if you're talking about like him making $2 million, it was still in that like kind of margin for error. Maybe not. That's where you get to the point where, he throws a lot of hanging sweepers and he got away with it in the first half, not so much in the second half. It's a case where because he was and right now is the only contributing member of the Dylan Cease trade that they don't want to let him go. There's a little bit of like, got to cling on to him to try to make this work, that they hang on to him for no matter what figure. But I'm kind of on the fence, and it comes down to, I think, like, it could be a matter of like $800,000, like what it comes down to with the White Sox, just because while the money doesn't matter so much, it gets into, can he be optioned? He can't be outrighted, because he was already outrighted last year. So if he's outrighted again, off the 40-man roster, he can neglect free agency. So while they might be fine with the talent and salary, just they might want the flexibility if they don't feel that sure about him. They would like a guy they can option up and down, or just kind of treat as interchangeable with somebody else who's league minimum and just getting into their option cycle. So yeah, I could see it's going either way based on that figure. I think like anything, approaching 2 million and over, I think they might say no.
And then Derek Hill, do we even see enough of Derek Hill to really make a decision?
Defense looked fine. Like, defense looked good. There is a case where if they really valued Michael A. Taylor's defense in a backup role, like, I could see them bringing it back. But he seems like a minor league contract guy. He seems like somebody, not so much the salary, but the obligation would be the sticking point. He was waived by the Marlins. The White Sox cleaned him. Like, that has a minor league contract written all over it. So I would imagine he's non-tendered, but perhaps in the mix. Like, they have such an open outfield in the majors, probably going to be an open outfield in the minors, to where they need somebody to play good defense, whether in Chicago or Charlotte, to where he might look at the White Sox and say, "You're still my best opportunity," and vice versa, just to have that depth up the middle that they want to have. And if you have to know what Luis Robert Jr.'s status is, and assuming he comes back and how healthy he is, like, they can use up the middle defense. He could provide it. So while I'm saying non-tender, might not be the end of him just yet.
No, those are good points. Like, Tauchman, I'm with you. If he's willing to sign for $2 million because the outfield is so open, that's fine. I mean, he still walks more than 10% of the time. He can still be league average productive offensively. I just don't think you can count on him to play more than 90 games. It's the right meniscus tear that he had at the end of the season, which I don't know what his status is with that knee and the hamstrings. I mean, he can't run full speed, even though he acts like it defensively. And I admire how hard he plays every single day that when he gets to be in the lineup for the Chicago White Sox. I really do admire that. But you were talking about a guy with bad hamstrings, a right meniscus tear in his knee at age 36. Like, at some point, the bottom's going to fall out here for Tauchman, unfortunately. Wilson and Hill, I think I would non-tender, and then, yeah, minor league deals. If they can't find a deal elsewhere, they can compete for a job in spring training.
I should say, going back to Steven Wilson, I talked around it because I realized I wasn't positive about it when I started talking. He actually has all three options left, which is weird. He was
So he
DFA'd
can't be
before.
outrighted?
He can be outrighted. Like, if they want him off the 40-man roster entirely, they can't do that without him getting a chance to elect free agency and pick a different team, because they've already outrighted him once. However, like, if they signs for like 1.1 million, he's not getting the job done, they can option him down. So he's in a weird spot. Like, somehow it's a weird career. He's 31 years old. He's got 3+ years of service time, and he's never been optioned. A
Wow.
fascinating existence.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to see your guys' off-season plans, because I don't know how much space that you're gonna use as far as both mentally thinking about it and then typing it out when you're writing up your off-season plans when it comes to the arbitration cases for the White Sox. It's not a long list. Now, I would, if you're looking for targets to the White Sox, look at other teams in their arbitration. The Rays have like more than a dozen guys hitting arbitration. Like, they seem to be a target, because once for some of their players, once they hit like a couple years at arbitration, they love to just trade those guys away. So maybe the White Sox can make some more deals with Tampa Bay. Chris Getz likes dealing with the Rays as well, as much as the Milwaukee Brewers, it seems like. So definitely look at other teams' arbitration, because if guys were hurt or they didn't have a strong 2025, those could be targets for the White Sox, as well as we still don't know where the White Sox are financially as far as what kind of player payroll that they're going to be able to have in 2026. We all still might be shopping in the target clearance aisle.
Probably.
And then finally, the Savannah Bananas. they announced their world tour schedule is before the weekend, and they are coming back to Chicago. They will be playing at Wrigley Field this time around in 2026. The ticket lottery is now open all the way up to Halloween. So if you read my post about the Savannah Bananas experience, if you missed out when they played at Wrigley Field this past summer, you can sign up for the lottery at the Savannah Bananas website. And if you are lucky, you can win tickets depending on the location that you selected. I actually selected the Superdome. It would be kind of fun and weird to see the Bananas play a baseball game in New Orleans in the Superdome. If I win the lottery, great. Then I have an excuse to go down to New Orleans, which I do love visiting that city. It's not the Bananas, though. You have the Party Animals and the Tailgaters, the two of the teams of the Savannah Bananas. They're going to be playing a series in June 2026 at the Nashville Sound Stadium. Is that of interest to you, Jim? Would you take Mini Margulis to go see the Party Animals and Tailgaters?
Probably not him. Probably not Mini Margulis, just because he lasts about five innings a normal game and he likes room to run around. He pays partial attention, but likes going on the amusement park at the and going on the big slide at the stadium. So probably not paying those prices by myself or like with friends. I'm curious what the market will be like. They sold out at Nissan Stadium when the Bananas proper played there, and I had no interest in competing for those tickets. But if it's a case where they're reasonable and nothing better to do, check out the vision of what this league is trying to do. Like, it's probably educational for me to do so. So I'm open to it. But in the case where if it's anything like what the tickets were like for Nissan Stadium, pass. Just don't want to compete for that. Don't want to, you know, just it seems like the people who are gunning for those tickets want it more than I do. So I will step out of the way and let them have it.
Yeah. Okay. The Wrigley Field Savannah Bananas games. If you don't win the draft lottery for those and you go to the third party sites, expensive. It'll be very, very expensive. But I bring this topic up because there's one site that did draw my attention. The Savannah Bananas are going to play a series at the University of Tennessee Football Stadium, Neyland Stadium. And the Volunteers Football Stadium seats almost 102,000 people, Jim. So we're going to be talking about more than 100,000 people watching a Savannah Bananas game. I have to imagine with all the places that Major League Baseball have been playing games the last few years, that this will catch Rob Manfred's attention. If the Bananas can sell more than 100,000 people for a single baseball game or a couple of baseball games, why don't we as Major League Baseball attempt to do the same thing? Is this the next neutral site, neutral location idea for Major League Baseball? If the Bananas pull it off at a college football stadium, could we see a Major League Baseball series played at a college football stadium to exceed crowds of over 100,000?
I guess they tried to do that last year with Bristol Speedway. I think that was like 90,000 okay. or so, and it didn't look like a great time. I mean, part of it was the weather, but you know, because the weather pushed it back and they had to, you know, carry it into a second day and attendance wasn't that great. I don't know if the reward is there. I think to me, having seen the White Sox and Yankees in Dyersville, like that was cool. Seeing the Giants and Cardinals at Rickwood and seeing those stands full and seeing it tap into like the pastoral history of baseball, tap into the Negro Leagues history of baseball. I think that's really, to me, more of an appealing TV event or like a just the jewel event in the regular season, having those small intimate settings. Because I suppose, like, yeah, I was thinking about it, trying to think of a player who would be so closely associated with, like, who's a good, I mean, the first one that came to mind was, like, Alex Bregman, LSU, like, having him, you know, like, a game where, you know, he brings in the local fans and they go nuts. Is there, like, a MLB either team or player that would be so closely identified with the college to where, like, they could turn into a college home game at a ballpark.
Well, if you did, okay, let's say Tennessee, you could have Todd Helton come back. If you have the Rockies play, if you have the Colorado Rockies play a game at Rocky Top, the marketing is just right there for Major League Baseball. But yeah, if you have Todd Helton
and like Garrett Crochet starting for the Red Sox.
There you go. Yeah. We just figured it out. Red Sox, Rockies, Neyland Stadium, Garrett Crochet pitching. Yeah, you would have 100,000 fans in attendance.
I think you'd have to try to tap into the college baseball part of it more than like trying to compete with the bananas, making it more of like a draft thing. Or like, here's where, like, the angle would have to be, okay, here's where these players come from, and here's who they're playing in front of. These colleges remember these players. And in order to build up, I think, because we've seen baseball try to time and time again to try to generate interest in the draft. And I think, you know, maybe tying it to college baseball might be the way to go. But even then, I could see it being difficult or being forced, kind of falling flat, to where I still think the strength is these smaller venues, even like creating pop-up venues out of nowhere and playing them in like beautiful settings. Because the cool thing about baseball that I think, you know, NFL can't play in front of like 5,000 people and it'd be cool. Like, it would look kind of flat. And, you know, kind of thinking about like Northwestern playing on the lakefront stadium and seeing just half of it being high school stands, basically. And not looking that impressive. Like, you can't, as storied as football is in the high school ranks in Texas, if you drop two NFL teams into like a good but small Texas football field, I don't think it shows up that impressive on TV. Probably cool to see it up close in person, but as a TV event, like NFL is so optimized for TV and big stadiums, all the angles, that wouldn't work. But I think baseball has an advantage of being played in front of like 500 to 50,000 people, that I think the flexibility and the appeal for these events made for TV are going small with awesome backdrops and fitting a stadium for a temporary purpose in a place where you wouldn't expect it.
The other idea I just thought of, because like when it comes to the college football stadiums, I do like the idea that you brought up that you'd be tied it to the MLB draft. Like, if you have Garrett Crochet coming back and pitching for in front of the University of Tennessee, the slam dunk one, Pirates Houston Astros series at LSU, Death Valley, get Paul Skeens to pitch one of those games. A lot of people in Louisiana and Houston, it's not that far of a drive. There you go. LSU would be packed if Skeens is pitching that game, LSU is going to be packed. And if probably make a lot of Pirates fans unhappy. Be like, what are you talking about? Sending home games from Pittsburgh down to Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
But I think you need to generate like that in order to create the atmosphere. You need to create like a college football atmosphere in the stands, which I don't think the bananas can do. I think bananas set the agenda with their stunts and they make the fans respond to them with like programming versus sports fans responding to sports. I think would be like that Paul Skeens in front of an LSU crowd. It would be like just it'd be a weird dynamic depending on who the home team is, who's going nuts for what. But if you want the towels going and you want just the deafening noise of like a two strike count with a runner in scoring position in a one run game, like that would be that would set the decibel meter ablaze, I think, in a way that would be one reason to do it.
Yeah. Again, though, I know Major League Baseball is paying close attention to the Savannah Bananas. The Dodgers president, he was just on CNBC, and he was asked about the Bananas, and he admitted even the Los Angeles Dodgers right now are paying close attention to the way that the Bananas market. It sounds like the Bananas are going to be part of the 2026 MLB All-Star facilities in Philadelphia next summer. They sell over 100,000 tickets. I just know in my gut, Jim, Rob Manfred is going to go to his event staff at the commissioner's office in New York and asking them, how can we do this? And I think you are right. If you tie it to college baseball heroes coming back, Tennessee's great. So many great Tennessee ball players now. Maybe you can do it in Nashville at the Tennessee Titans Stadium with so many Vanderbilt guys. And of course, we use Paul Skeens for LSU, but there's so many great LSU players as well that are in the majors. There you go. I like that idea. But again, MLB's going to see 100,000 fans for a Bananas game and ask, why can't we do that? So it's coming. I just don't know in what shape or form yet, Jim, but it's coming.
I just hope they don't chase attendance for attendance.
They will.
It just looked so sad at Bristol last year. It wasn't their fault, but still, it just didn't work out. And when it doesn't work out, it does look underwhelming. And like all this marketing and all this hype and all, you know, all these cameras for this, a little flat.
Has there ever been an MLB game played in Louisiana? Did the White Sox play there in their World Tour back in the 1910s?
Yeah, I think there have been games played in New Orleans, just, you know, teams, especially when spring training was kind of scattered and not in formal Grapefruit and Cactus League play. There would be teams doing spring training in Texas, and they would barnstorm their way back to their home parks and play teams along the way and play exhibitions along the way. So I imagine there have been major league teams playing in New Orleans at various points, whether it's exhibitions during the season, exhibitions before the season, after the season. So, yeah.
But we don't know. I don't know off the top of my head if a regular season game has been played in Louisiana. Again, let us know what you guys think. Just in my gut, I know MLB is going to be probably trying to answer how they can have 100,000 people at a baseball game in the future. If the Bananas can do it, damn it, why can't we? Type of mentality. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. Our future episodes are going to be our recaps of the 2025 season and break it down by position. We're going to start with the relievers in the next episode because the bullpen is going to be one of the top priorities for the White Sox as far as finding solutions. So we'll be recapping and try to come up with ideas. These podcasts are to help you get started to think different angles with your off-season plan projects as we get closer to the GM meetings in November. So you have that to look forward to. And if you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen and watch our shows on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. If you have Instagram, we're trying to build up our audience over at Instagram. Follow us over there. We are at Sox Machine. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, sign up to become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5, and that gets you the ad-free version of both the podcast and the website. We also have additional tiers of support that give you additional benefits. We still have some spots open at our Veterans Committee. So if you want to be part of our monthly Zoom calls, if you want to learn more about as far as our strategy of going into 2026, you want to be part of the group chat to have direct access to Jim and James, you can bug both of them with all of your questions regarding the White Sox and Major League Baseball. Again, we do have some spots open in our VC. You can inquire within at SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.